on The Voice of America.
VOA's Joe Ramsey with your worldwide news update. The Pentagon said on Thursday that there are a lot more U.S. troops in Syria than previously disclosed, and they've been there a while. AP correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
The U.S. had been saying there was no change to force numbers in Syria amid the Assad regime's fall, insisting 900 troops were there. Now,
there are approximately 2,000 U.S. troops in Syria.
Major General Pat Ryder says it's a temporary boost to help U.S. operations against the Islamic State group. How long have they been there?
It would probably be fair to say at a minimum months.
The revelation comes weeks before Donald Trump's return here to the White House. He tried to withdraw U.S. forces from Syria during his first term and says he does not back more getting involved there. Sagar Magani at the White House.
U.S. President Joe Biden will travel to Italy next month to meet with Pope Francis and top Italian officials for what is expected to be the final international trip of his presidency. White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre said Thursday that Biden will meet with the Pope, Italian Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni, and President Sergio Mattarella during the January 9th to 12th trip. Biden is a practicing Roman Catholic and last met privately with Francis earlier this year while in Italy for the Group of Seven Leaders meeting. He also met with Francis at the Vatican in 2021 when they had a wide-ranging conversation about climate change, poverty, and the coronavirus pandemic. Overseas visits this late in the U.S. presidency aren't typical. The last president to travel overseas in the final month of his presidency was fellow one-termer George H.W. Bush, who traveled in early January 1993. This is VOA News. President Vladimir Putin has boasted that his military operation in Ukraine has strengthened Russia and denied that the downfall of a key ally in Syria has dented Moscow's prestige. The Russian leader sought to project strength and ease at his annual news conference and call-in show Thursday. He used the tightly choreographed event to reinforce his authority and demonstrate a sweeping command of everything from consumer prices to military hardware. Moscow's forces are advancing at their fastest rate since 2022, capturing village after village across the industrial Donbas region. Both sides are vying for the upper hand ahead of expected peace efforts next year. Reuters correspondent Zachary Goldman has more.
Ukrainian officials are urging Kiev's Western partners to help strengthen Ukraine's position by supplying more weapons and air defenses. But hampered by manpower shortages, Kiev is on the back foot in several sectors of the Eastern Front, where soldiers have described relentless Russian assaults. Moscow's forces are now just 3 kilometers from the strategic city of Pokrovsk, a road and rail hub whose capture would severely disrupt Ukrainian supply lines. Far from the trenches, meanwhile, Moscow is waging a campaign of airstrikes on critical infrastructure that is hobbling Ukraine's fragile energy grid as winter takes hold. U.S. President-elect Donald Trump, who takes office next month and has criticized U.S. aid to Ukraine, has promised to seek a swift end to the war without specifying how.
Reuters correspondent Zachary Goldman. A court document filed on Thursday shows the suspect in the killing of an American healthcare executive, Luigi Mangione, is being charged with new federal murder and stalking crimes. Reuters correspondent Olivia Zelina reports.
The development came on the same day Mangione agreed to be sent to New York to face other state charges that had previously been announced by prosecutors there. Mangione waived his right to extradition proceedings in Pennsylvania, where he was arrested earlier this month. The federal prosecutors in Manhattan are charging him with the crime of murder using a firearm, 2 charges of stalking, and an additional firearms offense, according to a criminal complaint. Federal charges potentially allow prosecutors to pursue the death penalty, which has been outlawed in New York for decades. A grand jury in New York has already indicted Mangione on 11 counts, including first-degree murder and murder as an act of terrorism. The 26-year-old has been in jail since his arrest and has not yet entered a plea.
Reuters correspondent Olivia Zolino. That wraps up this update, but the world and news never stop. For additional updates, visit our website, voanews.com. I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
Congress is working overtime to avoid a government shutdown.
The deal, which would have extended the U.S. debt limit through 2027, failed Thursday night.
Turkey is flexing its diplomatic muscles in the Balkans.
The Balkans is quite a successful story for Ankara.
And a look at Ukrainian troops being trained in NATO countries.
The better the troops, units, and subdivisions are trained, the more effective they are on the battlefield.
Today is Friday, December 20th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Steve Karish in Washington.
I'm Alexis Strobe. Starting us off today is the prospect of a government shutdown in the U.S. President-elect Donald Trump objected late Wednesday to a bipartisan deal to fund the U.S. government through next March. Trump called on lawmakers to renegotiate a deal that would include raising the debt ceiling, a controversial proposal that increases the prospect of a government shutdown over the holiday season. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson has more.
U.S. lawmakers are running out of time to pass a spending deal to keep the U.S. government open past this Friday. Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson.
It's a long process. Sometimes it takes a while to reach consensus.
The deal, which would have extended the U.S. debt limit through 2027, failed Thursday night. It was negotiated in a matter of hours after President-elect Donald Trump posted to his Truth Social site that Republicans should vote on raising the debt ceiling before passing a funding bill. One analyst told VOA that was a difficult demand. Kevin Kosar is a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute.
To some degree, it's to his advantage. If Congress now deals with it, then he won't have to bargain with it later or bear the brunt of, you know, the populist backlash for increasing the debt limit. On the other hand, it's a late in the game demand. Congress is trying to close up before the Christmas holiday and get out of town. And raising the debt limit is an extremely hard vote.
Trump endorsed the new deal negotiated Thursday afternoon, but members of the conservative House Freedom Caucus rejected it, arguing Republicans are recklessly approving spending the nation can't afford. Republican Representative Chip Roy.
$330 billion. Congratulations. You've added to the debt since you were given the majority again on November 5th. It's embarrassing. It's shameful.
And Democrats, who said they negotiated in good faith, refused to vote for it as well. Hakeem Jeffries is the top Democrat in the U.S. House of Representatives.
And the extreme MAGA Republicans decide to do the bidding of the wealthy, the well-off, the well-connected millionaires and billionaires, not working-class people all across America.
The original bipartisan agreement included $100 billion in disaster aid and billions for American farmers and would have funded the government through mid-March. But earlier Wednesday, Elon Musk, the richest man in the world and a Trump ally, wrote on his social media platform X, "Stop the steal of your tax dollars." One analyst told VOA the move represents a new way of governing. Tom Schatz is the president of Citizens Against Government Waste.
The difference between efforts to eliminate wasteful spending in the past and today is social media. Taxpayers have a greater opportunity to make their views known to members of Congress, and it can be done more quickly. If there is legislation to consolidate departments or programs, there can be a faster and more comprehensive response because of social media.
If lawmakers can't reach an agreement by Friday night, millions of federal workers will be furloughed or work without pay. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
Now, if the government were indeed to shut down, what would it mean? Would American soldiers and intelligence operatives stop working? Would customs agents and border guards stay at home? Would U.S. embassies abroad close their doors? Would the Voice of America stop broadcasting? Catherine Gibson is back to explain.
Well, what a shutdown means is that there's no money going out to pay government workers, to pay for the services funded by government programs. It just simply means that Congress hasn't allotted that money to go out. What's really interesting about government shutdowns here in the United States is that a significant portion of the government continues working. There's something called essential workers, and that's pretty much what they sound like. They do. It means their work is so essential that they keep on working even through a shutdown, but they don't get paid.
So I was going to ask that. It's not like the government goes away. I mean, the Army is still patrolling. Voice of America is still broadcasting. Customs border agents are still at the airports and at the border crossings checking people. So who decides who goes to work and who doesn't? How does that happen?
Well, there's a legal definition of what it means to be an essential government employee, and obviously that varies from government agency to government agency, depending on that agency's mission. So really, it's a sense of, you know, what can we do with a bare-bones crew of people, the people who absolutely have to be working. All of those people still need to do their jobs, whether they're getting paid or not. And, you know, what's really interesting is that we've had kind of a new question. We've had these government shutdowns before in the past few years in the U.S., but I don't think we've ever had one while there was planning for a presidential inauguration. And my understanding is, yes, those people who are planning and prepping for that inauguration of President-elect Donald Trump on January 20th of next year are deemed essential, and they will continue working.
Interesting. I hadn't thought of that. What about the folks who don't live in the United States, who might need to visit an American embassy in their country, or who might interact with the American military or Department of Defense where they live?
Right. So in the case of passports, embassy services, again, it's going to be an essential kind of bare-bones crew that is running these things, so processing times might be a little bit slower, but military services won't be impacted. Just remember that all of these people won't be getting paid while they're doing the work for the U.S. government.
I'm going to put you on the spot here. How long do these typically last? I know we've had a couple very big ones recently, but this isn't the first time this has happened.
That is definitely always a million-dollar question whenever we are facing the looming threat of a government shutdown. We had a pretty long one back in 2013. I think that was somewhere in the neighborhood of 30 to 34 days. Others have lasted over a weekend. They really vary in length, and there's some talk that it wouldn't be done this time around until January 20th, when President-elect Trump is sworn in back into office and goes back into the White House.
Now, Catherine, you've covered Washington for a long time. You've covered Congress for a long time. You've done this story before about government shutdowns.
True.
Is it different this time? Is there more anger, more animosity, more partisanship, especially with the new presidential administration starting soon?
No, I've seen very, very divisive government shutdowns in the past, and debates that almost turned into government shutdowns. There was a shutdown during Trump's first term over building the border wall. That got very ugly very quickly. I think what's different here is that we're anticipating a new presidential administration, so potentially that shutdown could impact the beginning of President Trump's second term, and that's a really strange position for the United States to be in, to be inaugurating a new president and not be paying government employees at the same time.
And we'll leave it there for tonight. Catherine Gibson covers the Congress for VOA. She joined us from Capitol Hill. Catherine, thanks for taking the time for us on what is no doubt a busy night.
Always good to talk to you.
Turning our attention now to Eastern Europe and Eurasia now. Russia has long considered the Balkans as part of its sphere of influence, but its current focus on its war in Ukraine is creating a power vacuum in the region and giving Turkey an opportunity to expand its role. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has been stepping up efforts to expand Turkey's influence in the Balkans, hosting Montenegro Prime Minister Milojko Spajic in December after paying visits to Albania and Serbia in October. Vuk Vuksanović of the Belgrade Center for Security Policy.
The Balkans is quite a successful story for Ankara. And the number one reason for that is because Turkey has been successful to act as something of a broker, capable of maintaining parallel links with all the governments and all the ethnic groups.
Muslim-majority Turkey has long had strong ties with largely Muslim Albania. But Erdogan has also recently developed a strong relationship with Serbia, one that's built on deepening economic relations and a personal relationship with Serbian President Aleksandar Vučić. Russia has historically considered Serbia part of its sphere of influence, but has been distracted by its war in Ukraine, something that's working to Turkey's advantage. Hüseyin Bağca is a professor of international relations at Ankara's Middle East Technical University.
Definitely, Russia has always used Serbia for its own strategic interest. The problem is Putin at the moment is not so strong, despite the fact that in Serbia there are political parties and intellectuals who directly favor the Russian policy.
Russia and NATO have in the past backed rival sides in Balkan conflicts, most recently over Kosovo, where tensions continue to simmer, and a NATO-led peacekeeping force is still deployed. The continuing threat of instability makes Ankara's growing involvement important. Analyst Vuk Vuksanović.
Turkey does have a military presence in the Balkans. It has boots on the ground by virtue of participating in NATO and EU peacekeeping efforts in the Balkans. And at the same time, sometimes if there is any possibility of any sort of tensions, Turkey might try to accumulate some diplomatic and political points by trying to be something as a go-between the involved parties.
Stability in the Balkans is also vital for Turkey because the region is a critical trade route between Turkey and its most important trading partner, the European Union. Erdogan's recent visits to the Balkans have taken place against a backdrop of growing frustration among these countries over their stalled bids to join the EU. Zoran Ivanov of Ankara's top University of Economics and Technology.
Ankara seeks to position itself as an indispensable partner for the region and often viewed by Europeans region as a periphery, right? And this visit also, speaking on a wider scale, I think it's intended to counterbalance the European Union indecision and trying to outmaneuver Russia and China.
The Balkans region, with its simmering rivalries and frozen conflicts, is becoming the scene of a new battle for influence between historic and emerging powers. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
And here are some more stories we're following from around the world.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken announced $200 million in humanitarian aid for conflict-torn Sudan during what was likely his final trip to the United Nations while in office. Additionally, at the UN while there, he also chaired two meetings, one focused on artificial intelligence and the other, Sudan.
A French court found all 51 defendants guilty on Thursday in a drugging and rape case that horrified the world and transformed the victim, Gisèle Pelicot, into a stirring symbol of courage and resilience. Dominique Pelicot, Gisèle Pelicot's ex-husband, confessed to drugging her repeatedly for almost a decade to rape her and offer up her unconscious body for sex to dozens of strangers he had met online, all while recording the abuse.
Several children died during a stampede Wednesday at a holiday fair in southwestern Nigeria. The incident happened at the Islamic High School in Basaran near Lagos. Local media identified the event organizers as the Women in Need of Guidance and Support Foundation. A local radio station said the group was preparing to host up to 5,000 young people at this year's event. Officials said an investigation has been opened into the causes of the stampede.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Karish.
And I'm Alexis Strobe. U.S. President-elect Donald Trump says the leaders of Ukraine and Russia should be prepared to make a deal to end the brutal conflict that has consumed Ukraine since 2022. He also slammed President Joe Biden's decision to allow Ukraine to strike inside Russian territory with U.S.-provided weapons, hinting that when he takes office, he may reverse the move. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Washington.
President-elect Donald Trump says he'll try for a peace deal between Russia and Ukraine at the start of his next presidential term, and said both sides may have to compromise.
It's got to be a deal. No, it's got to be a deal. Too many people being killed. That is a war that's too many. We've got to make a deal. And Putin has to make a deal.
He also called President Joe Biden's decision to let Ukraine lob long-range weapons into Russia stupid and a big mistake. The next day, Kyiv took the fight to the heart of Moscow, with Ukrainian security forces claiming responsibility for the brazen assassination of a key Russian general by a bomb hidden in a scooter and detonated just kilometers from Red Square. Analyst William Pomerantz said a future Trump decision to roll back support would have significant military consequence for Ukraine and could pit Trump against U.S. allies. Pomerantz formerly directed the Wilson Center's Cannon Institute, named for the Cold War U.S. diplomat credited for the long-running U.S. policy of containment, aimed at preventing the spread of communism after World War II. That policy led directly to the formation of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, a security bloc stood up to counter the Soviet Union.
I see a potential clash between our NATO allies and President Trump as to what is the future of the war. And quite frankly, when Trump talks about negotiations, it really means that Ukraine has to negotiate and surrender, as it were, but he doesn't really put any conditions on Russia.
The departing Biden administration is trying to spend every penny of available Ukraine security assistance before he leaves office. A National Security Council official explained why to VOA. Michael Carpenter, NSC Senior Director for Europe, painted Ukraine as the first domino that could tip and send the current world order tumbling down.
Ukraine is about the fundamental basis within the international system upon which everything else rests. That's sovereignty, it's territorial integrity, it's the inviolability of borders. If you don't protect that in Ukraine, you don't protect it anywhere.
Congress ultimately decides whether to keep money flowing into Ukraine's fight. Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson to VOA.
I think that President Trump's election has already changed the equation there. I think he's the one that can bring that to a resolution, and we're looking forward to his leadership on that point. So we'll have to see.
Houston Democrat Erica Lee Carter, recently elected to serve the last few weeks of her late mother's congressional term, used her limited time in office to echo her mother's support for Ukraine.
I'm not counting out Ukraine until everyone in Ukraine stops fighting, and I don't see that happening until they win the victory.
Her observation highlights a significant issue, whether Ukraine is even ready to settle. Members of President Volodymyr Zelensky's government recently made the rounds, seeking support from neighbors such as Poland and from as far afield as France and Australia. When asked recently if he was ready to down arms and come to the negotiating table, Zelensky said he first needed to see security guarantees and a plan for peace. Anita Powell, VOA News, Washington.
In a related story, since Russia invaded Ukraine in February of 2022, Ukrainian soldiers have been receiving training from NATO troops. VOA recently visited one of these training sites where troops from Britain and Canada are training Ukrainian soldiers. Vladislav Andrevs has the story, narrated for us by Anna Rice.
Poland. Ukrainian tank crews are learning how to operate German tanks. NATO soldiers are mentoring Ukrainian troops as part of a military assistance program funded by the European Union. Ukrainian fighters are being taught by troops from Britain, Canada, and Poland.
We can operate all day long using the computer, so driver after the driver will be trained. Secondly, we save fuel for our tanks, and thanks to this, when the driver will go to the real tank, we are sure that he will avoid any mistakes, because all mistakes he did on the computer.
Training at this Polish Combined Arms Center near the German border includes training on tank simulators, as well as mastering all aspects of driving, servicing, and repairing German Leopards. And finally, maneuvers at maximum speeds. choosing exercises at the training grounds. Instructors say when Ukrainian fighters leave Poland, they're fully prepared to operate tanks during a real battle.
The better the troops, units, and subdivisions are trained, the more effective they are on the battlefield. We see that Russia, they're trying so hard to organize the offensive that they don't have time for sufficient training. And we see their losses.
Ukrainian troops are being trained in Lithuania as well. Lithuania is a NATO member, and both countries share a border with Russian-allied Belarus. These ongoing exercises have become much more intense since Russia invaded Ukraine in February 2022. In the last 2 months, junior officers of the Ukraine Armed Forces have received training here.
Some of them experienced NCOs already. They have combat experience, but there is also some students who don't have enough military experience probably. Just basic knowledges, and during this course, we train them more or less to the same level.
A lot of this training is focused on these mid-range commanders who will likely be on the front lines, teaching them to make quick decisions, be tactically flexible, and work easily with NATO troops.
The primary goal of NATO armies and, well, NATO as a full-on military force is standardization of all of its branches. So American troop can work with the Lithuanian troop.
Getting familiar with NATO procedures is all part of President Volodymyr Zelensky's desire to have Ukraine be part of NATO. Zelensky believes it is one way to guarantee lasting peace with Russia. He has also admitted that full NATO membership is not attainable during the ongoing war. For Vladislav Andreevs in Poland and Lithuania, NRI's VOA News.
Russian President Vladimir Putin held his annual press conference and televised phone-in show Thursday. The event lasted for almost 4.5 hours, with Putin answering dozens of questions both on foreign and domestic affairs. The questions are pre-screened and usually give Putin the opportunity to boast about his achievements. On Ukraine, Putin said that Russian forces are advancing toward their primary goals in Ukraine, taking control of significant territory daily. He claims the situation is changing dramatically. Movement is going on along the entire front line every day, and Russian fighters are taking and reclaiming territory in square kilometers every day. Putin addressed Western skepticism about the Oreshnik missile by mockingly suggesting a 21st century duel. Putin says there is no chance to shoot down the Oreshnik missiles, and if Western experts think it can be done, then he proposes those in the West and the United States choose a target in Kyiv, for example, concentrate their air defense and missile defense forces there, and see if they can block the Russian hypersonic ballistic missile. He says Russia is ready for such an experiment and asks if the other side is ready for it. Regarding potential talks with Donald Trump on ending the war, Putin stated his readiness for compromise. Putin says politics is the art of compromise, and Russia has always said that they are ready for both negotiations and compromises. It's just that the opposite side refused to negotiate. He added that, against much evidence to the contrary, Russia had strengthened significantly since he ordered troops into Ukraine in 2022. Regarding Syria, Putin denied that it was also a defeat for Russia, which helped prop up the Assad regime. Putin said, "We came to Syria 10 years ago so that a terrorist enclave would not be created there, like what we have seen in some other countries, like in, let's say, Afghanistan. Overall, we have achieved our goals." He mentioned that he plans to meet with Bashar al-Assad soon and that he wants to meet Syria's new leadership to discuss Russia's military bases there. He says Russia looks forward to peace in Syria, and Russia will maintain relations with all the groups that control the situation there. According to Putin, most of them say they would be interested in keeping Russian military bases in Syria. Putin also expressed his intention to inquire about the fate of missing U.S. reporter Austin Tice.
And that's going to wrap it up for today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for joining us.
For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com.
In Washington, I'm Steve Karish.
I'm Alexis Strope. Thanks for listening.